The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. If you haven't listened before, we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me this week is a malicious actor. Not the kind that's been editing Virtue's company's house records. Of course, this one just does a bit of Amdram. It's James Batchelor.
Hello, John.
Did you enjoy that? I can't take credit for that. That's a James Baggett joke.
So he prepped that, and he's now not on the podcast. I mean,
that's right. That's, you understand how he works. You know, he's out of the office, but he's still in control.
Amazing.
How's your week been?
I've had a very busy 7 days. I've been driving all sorts of new cars, which has been amazing. I've driven a new Chinese car, which was really impressive, actually, and listening to their UK MD. I mean, they haven't launched in the UK yet, but they've already got an MD for the UK and talking about battery swap tech and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, is this Neo?
It was Neo. It's very impressive. Then I drove a Mazda with a new Wankel engine, and stop giggling, John. It's very childish of you to giggle at that word. I drove a new Mazda with a Wankel engine, which was very interesting. And then I've also drove the new Volvo EX30, which I don't want to sort of make a prediction here, because I'm famously wrong on everything, but I think that's going to be the car of 2024, actually. It's a very, very interesting entry level Volvo.
It's quite well priced, isn't it? That's assuming they stick to the pricing that they've suggested.
Yes. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? It's all relative. You feel bad saying £34,000 is cheap, but as we know, in the world of electric cars, £34,000 is actually quite cheap. And
it is, and I think that's cheap for a premium compact SUV.
Not
cheap, but cheap for an electric one, definitely.
It is, yeah. And there is a bit of cachet around the whole Volvo badge, isn't there? So you're getting a Volvo for kind of like MG, Kia, Vauxhall. I mean, it undercuts a Vauxhall Mokka by £5,000, which is puts things into perspective. So yes, I've been very busy driving lots of interesting new electric cars.
Well, that's lovely. So I do have to ask, what did you make of the new Wankel Mazda? Because I'm deeply interested in that. As a previous MX-30... driver,
I'm going to be totally honest with you, it's a very difficult car to recommend to somebody, because it's a very interesting concept, but you really have to be a petrolhead to properly understand it, and if you are a petrolhead, you will love it. But unfortunately, as we all know, the vast majority of car buyers aren't petrolheads, and they will struggle to understand it, but it's an interesting car, and I liked it immensely.
Well, that's reassuring. I would like to have a go in that. Well, rather than talk about my week, because I've not done anything interesting, I'm just going to move straight on and introduce our guest. So our guest this week is Chris Ashton-Green, founder of Regit Cars. Welcome.
How you doing, guys? Nice to be on here. Thank you very much.
Well, it's lovely to have you on. I mean, just to get us started, your name will be familiar to a lot of people in the industry, I'm sure. But tell us a bit about you. What's your background?
Yeah, my background is automotive all my life, really, from the age of about 18. So, yeah, 35 years of industry experience working for dealer groups back in the day in my former life. A lot of people probably listening will remember the Smith Knight Fay Group and Ian Anthony, BMW. Those names have changed now. I think they're part of Inchcape and Williams. But worked for brands such as Vauxhall, Ford, Volkswagen, Audi, BMW, various different positions within the showroom. But that seems like a world away since we founded motoring.co.uk, which is now Regit, because we rebranded several years ago. Just you cut me in half, and there's automotive through and through, and now a little bit of digital media.
That's what we like. I was going to say as well, your first car sale was a bit of an unusual one, wasn't it?
Oh, you've done some research, right?
There is some background that goes into these podcasts, Chris, you know.
Yeah. Only a he's little bit.
Even,
but
yeah, bless him. He's not even alive now.
I know.
Actually, yeah. Mike Baldwin, Coronation Street, yeah.
I didn't know this story, really.
Yeah. It was actually the brand that just missed out. I started my sales trainee days at Mitsubishi in Swinton, it was, in Manchester back at the time. And he came in, Johnny, I think he was...
Johnny Briggs, that's him,
Johnny
yeah.
Briggs, yeah. And he bought a Mitsubishi Space Wagon off me. It was my first ever car sale. Yeah.
I didn't see that coming.
I think it's for his wife and the kids at the time. I don't think it was for him. But he was very nice, very flash, very, very Mike Baldwin, actually. If I'm honest. But my first ever sale. And my career seemed to have spanned in dealing with celebrities after that. Certainly when I moved to Volkswagen and Audi Smith Knight Fay, we won a Manchester United contract for about 2 or 3 years, and I ended up managing the contract, and I was a Manchester United fan, so I was selling cars to David Beckham, Eric Cantona, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I mean, you name it, I've pretty much sold cars to most. Paul Scholes, Ryan Giggs, I've sold cars to pretty much most of them. Roy Keane.
Have you sold a car to Ken Barlow?
No, yeah, you're talking to the wrong people here, you see. We're definitely more
he doesn't live far from here.
Hey, Bill Roach, if you're listening to this podcast, please get in contact with Chris Green.
Yeah, and he's not far away, old Ken, and he's still rocking and rolling around Cheshire and Wilmslow. He's fit as a fiddle, he really is.
Yeah, well, there we are. We were going to talk about Mike Baldwin today. That's made my year, that has.
Mike Baldwin in the Mitsubishi Space Wagon, who'd have thought?
John, where the hell did you get that information from, by the way?
I'd like to say I did deep research, but really, it's just at the bottom of your LinkedIn.
Oh, really? Is it?
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, we'll move on from Mike Baldwin. So tell us a bit about Regit.
Yeah, so, I mean, for the people that have been around and remember when we first launched, my co-founder, Terry Hogan, at the time, we launched motoring.co.uk. We bought the domain name for the industry. You know, how we bought that back then, I'll never know. It wasn't cheap, but it wasn't expensive for owning a domain name for the industry in the UK. And the business still owns that. It sits on our balance sheet. The URL sits on the balance sheet. We started like everybody trying to rival Auto Trader with a classified website, you know, and, you know, you need £100 million plus to do that. But we did some pretty groundbreaking stuff. I posted some stuff on LinkedIn actually the other week, which was quite interesting. I think we were the first business ever to allow car dealers to advertise for free. So one of the USPs when we launched was about how quickly can we get scale? How quickly can we get inventory? We wanted to have more cars than Auto Trader. We came close. We were about the second highest, I think. I think there was a time where we had about 300,000 used cars advertised as a classified website. That was a challenge getting dealers to pay 12, 18 months down the line, as you can imagine. And also, we were the first to ever allow free car valuations, which upset a few people in the industry, certainly the likes of Glasses and Cap back in the day when paid valuations were a consumer product, you know, to allow car owners to value their cars for free was also a little bit disruptive. Quite interestingly, it shows that even back then, we always had our eye on data. We were always going to be a data first business, even back then. And it stood us in really good stead today, actually. So, yeah, quite proud of that. But Regit now, as we've rebranded too, we thought motoring.co.uk was becoming a little, it was a bit generic. It was a little bit, what is it you actually do? Do you do used cars, new cars? Do you do content? And then we built this digital garage, which we called My Motoring, which was effectively from a simple entry of your registration number and your email address was create a personalized digital garage of you and your car. And then we would tell you when things were due. So when your service is due, your MOT is due, your tax is due, your insurance is due. And it was quite utilitarian back then. You know, now it's very content led. There's lots of tools in it. We ended up coming across quite a famous gentleman called Sir John Hegarty, which some people will know, certainly people within the Volkswagen Group and the Audi network will know who he is, because he was effectively the one that decided that Vorsprung Dirt Technique should be the Audi strap line. It was actually a line that they actually used internally, but they never used it externally, i.e. as a consumer perspective. And John, Sir John is former BBH, Bartle Bogle Hegarty advertising agency, and they had the creative and the ad contract for Audi. And then when John was in Germany, he came up with Vorsprung Dirt Technique, which is effectively, you know, progress through technology, I think it is. And, you know, he became a bit of a legend from there on. He's now an advisor to us from a creative perspective, and he was the one that decided that we should rebrand. You know, we've got this digital garage approach. We've got this, you know, this data first approach. And it was, who are you? What do you do? And I think we had some strap lines of, don't forget your MOT, just reg it. Don't forget your cap tax, just reg it. So in the end, one simple word, reg it, the digital garage for car owners. And that's pretty much who we are. And that allows us to do a whole host of things with OEMs, dealers, so new car lead generation, used car lead generation, email marketing, data research, data insight. You know, and we've got some great partners. We work with most of the top 20 car manufacturers from a new car lead generation perspective. And Heycar are our used car partners, so we generate leads for their dealer network.
Mm. Yeah, it's a clever operation, isn't it? Because from the consumer point of view, your proposition is, give us your reg and we will tell you all this information. We'll tell you, the latest one is, of course, ULEZ, isn't it? That must have been quite handy. Have you seen an uptick since you added the ULEZ stuff to the website?
You know, it's a great question that, John. And actually, one of the first uptakes we ever saw, bizarrely, was when we launched the digital garage. I don't know if you ever remember the government abolishing the tax disc in our windows, in the windscreens of our cars. And there was absolute uproar of people, you know, how are we going to remember when our tax is due? And actually, I think that some of the DVLA, DVSA stats back then was, I think there's something like on average about 2 or 3 million car owners driving around with no tax. Yeah. Whether that's, you know, illegally, or they're doing it on purpose, or whether they've forgotten. And that can be for a very short period of time. It can be for 2 days, 3 days. But on average, that's what it looks like. When the government abolished the tax discs, the stats were something like there was 11 million motorists driving around with no tax. And the uptake of people that we got signing up to reg it. So we did a Facebook campaign. We did some social media campaigns. And it was a real turning point in uplift of people, you know, creating an account with reg it, creating a digital garage. So we knew the timing of car ownership becoming digitized. And we're seeing that now. We've seen the paper counterpart of the driving license being abolished. MOT certificate is now talking about being abolished and all becoming digitized. So really good timing for us. But then going back to your point of view, Les, outside of TFL, we were the first business to build a ULEZ checker. So that data is open source, which a lot of people don't realize. Businesses like Motorway have copied us since then. You know, I'm quite flattered that we've got some big businesses that copy a lot of stuff that what we do. But we were the first outside of TFL to build a ULEZ checker. And going back to your point, when Sadiq, bless him, you know, is in a bit of trouble because of some of the things that he said around, obviously, London, as we've seen, and we do a campaign on social media, the input of users that we get, putting a registration number into ULEZ, creating a digital garage, works fantastically well. We did some TV advertising with Sky back in May, June, when we launched Reggie the Frog. So our first move into TV advertising was really exciting with Sky. And, you know, it was all about, is your car clean air compliant? Are you legal? Is your car MOT'd? Is your car taxed? And Reggie the Frog would go, Reggie, Reggie. So it was quite comical, quite humorous, but we also wanted a call to action approach of people putting registration numbers in, and that worked very, very well for tens of thousands of people creating an account from Sky Advertising. It was great.
Mm. Speaking of Sky, of course, there was some news from you recently. You launched quite an innovative thing with Sky, didn't you? Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. I'm still excited from when we signed the contract, I think about 6 weeks ago now. It was 2 years in the making to get this deal over the line. It was an idea that I came up with during COVID when the world was falling off a cliff. And I remember thinking to myself, we've got all this data. It's great that we work with car manufacturers and dealers and advertising agencies, but there must be something better that we can do with it. And I was at home with a glass of wine, like many people, watching Sky, and I got served this ad. And I thought, that's tailored to me in terms of where I am and where I live. Sky had smart technology, and they're the leaders in that, and they have been for 10 years. And then I just thought to myself, I wonder if we could attach our vehicle asset in a compliant, anonymized way, so GDPR compliant and anonymized, where we can attach the vehicle asset to Sky's home asset and effectively, between the two of us, launch a new addressable TV product in automotive where dealers could advertise with Sky, but they can now target by the home and the vehicle that they own and where they are in that car ownership life cycle, you know, so whether they're buying, selling, maintaining, et cetera, et cetera. And my non-exec director, Kevin Brown, who is a colleague of Sir John Hegarty's, he works with Sky with his ad agency. And I went to him, took the idea to him after we opened back up and said, I've got this idea, but I'm not quite sure if it's something we could execute. And he said, that's a fantastic idea. Let's get in front of Sky. I met a chap called Paul Barrett from Sky and several others there, some of the data guys, sales guys. And we took it as an idea and a presentation to Sky. They said it was perfect for the time that they were looking to innovate and evolve the AdSmart product. Went into some data matching. Compliance was a year, took a year to get through compliance. But I'm quite proud to say that we passed with flying colours, which tells you everything about our data and what we do with it and how we nurture it, harness it, and how compliant that it is. And then as of 6 weeks ago, contract was signed. Huge press release that Sky and Reggie, with a world first, have launched a new addressable TV product in automotive, and it's gone crazy.
Mm.
Brands, car brands, dealer groups, charging companies, mobility companies, insurance companies, car buying, car selling companies, out of nowhere, wanting to do advertising with Sky in 2024, utilizing our data. So
what sort of thing does this, sorry to interrupt, what sort of thing does it allow you to do? You know, if I'm, say I've got Sky and I own a Mercedes A-Class or something, what does it do with that information?
Yeah, so in short, you know, if Mercedes-Benz or any other car brands wanted to serve you a TV ad in relation to your home demographic and the vehicle that you now own, where you are in that car ownership life cycle, where, as an example, intent signals in terms of you looking to buy, looking to sell, or looking to maintain. Some of the obvious ones with the Reggie Digital Garage, we obviously have, you know, service expiry, MOT expiry, tax expiry, mileage, how long they've owned it. We can send intent, insight, and information through to Sky about users that we've now attached to the home who are reading electric vehicle content or hybrid content. So you can be served a tailored ad from Mercedes-Benz in relation to the vehicle you own and where you are in that car owning life cycle. Mm. So just like Sky have always been doing within the home, but now we've attached a vehicle asset, which means they can now serve automotive related ads to where you are in that car ownership. It's super, super smart, you know, super clever, and has allowed Sky and their AdSmart product to really evolve and innovate, which they need to do when they've got competition coming like Amazon, ITV launching the likes of Planet V, So they've now, for the first time, got some competitors in the market that they've probably never had. So to be able to do a partnership like this. And the great thing is there's more to the partnership. Sky are going to help us grow our brand and scale our data really aggressively, because the bigger the data matching gets into the Sky ecosystem, the more opportunity for Sky, the more ad revenues, the more commission back to us, and obviously helping us scale our brand, build our data aggressively is really great for our business in terms of value and brand building.
So are you their only automotive partner, Chris, or are they talking to other people? I suppose you might not know that, but...
So Batch, that was a really, really great, insightful question. So obviously, in terms of the contract, which, you know, as far as I was concerned, that was my IP, our IP, you know, my idea. And I know that as soon as that press release went out there, some of the bigger competitors, you know, your Auto Traders, et cetera, and your Bowers, your Haymarkets, anyone that's got an automotive type title with a bit of data, first thing they're going to think is, oh, we could do that. So part of the negotiations were exclusivity on both sides. And the exclusivity on both sides were, as an example, we wouldn't take this idea to ITV, to the likes of YouTube, Amazon, except anyone who potentially we could do something similar to. So we've got a list from Sky where we can't do this partnership with their list of exclusivity. And we've also got a list who, you know, who in the contract, a lot of people that I've named, et cetera, effectively can't go to Sky and do a similar thing. So we've got exclusivity on both sides.
Yeah, it's just I know that there have been various things, not automotive, but various things like this that Sky has been doing for a while. But it's the kind of thing you were told like years ago that that's what TV of the future is going to be like. It's going to be personalized, and it's not going to be, you know, it's going to be sort of generated for you, isn't it? And now it's sort of, you know, becoming a reality. It's quite amazing, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's incredibly. Incredibly innovative, I think, you know, and I think that in the world that we're in now, certainly with data and compliance and things like that, some of these ideas never get executed for one reason or another. You know, when you've got Sky that has explicit consent and we've got consent, and you're able to match two data sets in a consented compliant environment, and you go through that compliance with legals and lawyers and everything else, it takes a long time to get that sort of innovative idea away. And a lot of them don't get there. You know, lots of ideas don't get executed. You know, we've had other ideas that we've not managed to get off the ground. We've not managed to perhaps, you know, see them through for one reason or another. Sometimes it's not really been on our part, it's been on other parts. But as an entrepreneurial business, you know, we can't stand still. As an SME that is classed as a disruptor, we can't stand still. We have to be forward thinking. We have to be coming up with different ideas. We have to evolve. We have to innovate. Luckily, in someone like Sky, I think the timing was right for them. They've been doing this kind of addressable, you know, more personalized TV advertising for 10 years, and they'd pretty much had it all their own way. And I think that the timing for them to evolve and innovate, looking at perhaps some of the competition was coming, was perfect for us all, perfect for both parties.
I'm just amazed that you were coming up with such an inspirational idea during COVID, and I was just sitting on the sofa watching box sets of Poirot. So congratulations, because I couldn't do that.
Yeah, and the James Batchelor Detective Agency will be opening any day now.
It will be.
Waiting for compliance, aren't you?
Yeah, offering a personalised service. So
absolutely.
It was the only idea I came up during COVID. Most of it was sitting there drinking wine, panicking.
As we all
along with the rest of us. Yeah. We laugh about it now, of course.
Yes.
Well, I'll move us on to our stories, because I think we've got quite a lot to discuss. I'm sure we'll chat about each one as we go through. So if you haven't listened before, Batch and I have chosen our favourite stories from the car dealer website this week. We don't know what each other has chosen, and we're going to have a chat about each story as we go through. At the end, Chris gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. If you want to play along, you can X at Car Dealer Mag and let us know if you think we've missed anything. I lost last week. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Batch.
Oh, gosh. Okay. well, I feel as though we've got to start with the big thing that we've done this week, which is publish our top 100. So if you don't know what that is, it's we've compiled, we do it every year. It's a top 100 list of the most profitable car dealers in the UK. It might not come as much of a surprise that Arnold Clark has come number one, like it has done since we first started this list. And I'm not going to go into too much detail about it because it's quite a difficult thing to talk about on the podcast. So if anyone is interested,
car dealers, yeah,
please do go to our website. But the thing that I just wanted to talk about a little bit is Arnold Clark, because I was reading a story and listening to watching James's video on it as well. And it's very easy, isn't it? It's very easy to get swept along with this view that I suppose is put out by car manufacturers that, you know, dealers aren't as relevant, aren't as important as perhaps they once were, and manufacturers can do it all themselves and what have you. And when we're moving away from the traditional days of car dealers being on every street corner and what have you. And also this notion that customers want an easy, a pain-free buying process that's online. But I mean, you only have to look at this list, and it shows you that car dealers are doing a great job at the moment. They're making lots and lots of money. You know, that you can't beat a big car dealer group that has mass coverage, that has hundreds of dealers and has amazing brand awareness, and customers obviously still want to interact and do business with firms such as these. So I mean, it's probably not a particularly great story to start off with, because that's all I really want to say about it. But you know, if anyone's interested, go and look at our website and read more about it. But I don't know if you've got any views on that, Johnny Ray.
Well, I mean, I have views on the top 100, but interestingly, on what you just said, tying back to what you've been driving this week, am I right in thinking NIO, and forgive me if I've got this wrong, because there is a Chinese brand that started operating with agency sales, has realized it's not already, sorry, not agency sales, started operating direct to consumers, yes, have realized it's not working for them and now looking for dealer partners. Is that NIO, if I imagine that?
Well, you probably haven't seen the latest news, because I only just published it just before this podcast.
How rude.
Started recording. But I had my conversations with NIO, and I put that question to them because there have been some rumors that they are looking for dealer partners. The UKMD told me that that's categorically not true. Well, categorically not the case at the moment. They are continuing with this direct sales process. But it is an interesting one, because, you know, you look at Genesis, who launched, sort of in the UK during COVID, didn't they? 2020, I think it was. And they said they were going to have an online sales model. And then the beginning of this year, they sat down with us and told us that actually they're going to actually create a UK dealer network. Because they want to boost their brand awareness and they want to boost their car sales. And obviously car dealers are the way to do that. You know, there's no better billboard for a car manufacturer, is there, to have a big car dealership with all their branding all over it. So, that's one of the takeaways that I took away from the Car Dealer Top 100 this year.
I mean, the other interesting thing is, of course, we organize this by EBITDA earnings. Well, earnings before. I've forgotten the rest of the abbreviation. But if you'd organized it by operating profit, Arnold Clark would not actually be at the top this year. It would be Sytner, interestingly.
Yes.
So there's Sytner rapidly approaching Arnold Clark levels almost. I mean, I don't think I'm not quite sure of their comparative sizes, but they've got a bit of a fight on their hands, it looks like, over the next few years.
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Did you see any of our lists?
Sorry?
Did you see any of our list?
I haven't actually, but I have read the latest press release regarding Arnold Clark and that they're still number one in terms of EBIT and profitability. Doesn't surprise me, actually. And I think I was at, you couldn't have timed this any better. I was actually at Arnold Clark in Glasgow on Tuesday, funnily enough. And I've not been there for over 10 years. And they've got a new head office now. Mm. And honestly, the old head office, as I'm sure anybody will tell you, left a little bit to be desired. But the new one is absolutely fantastic. It's like going to a mini Google or a mini Facebook. It's seriously impressive. It really, really is. But the reason why I'm not surprised is if you look at Arnold Clark as a top five group, which obviously they are, along with your Sytners and your Inchcapes, et cetera, et cetera. Is it a coincidence that they're still privately owned rather than a PLC? Because I think if you look at automotive and you look at the volatility, you look at what's changing, and going to your point that they've been number one since you started doing this, and I don't know how long that's for, by the way, but I think that they've got a competitive edge in terms of entrepreneurialism, being more agile, not necessarily having to go through so much red tape to distort share price, et cetera, when they want to pivot, move, do something different. I don't think it's I don't think it's a coincidence that they're still number one in terms of profitability, because they do move quickly, they do pivot, and they are very, very entrepreneurial as a business. So it doesn't surprise me at all. Going back to your Sytner point where they've come close, obviously Sytner is really a lot of high-end luxury brands. Mm. And I think we all know post-COVID how you know, the increase in luxury brand sales and premium brand sales have been. That's now on a downturn, as we know, as of the latest stats and analysis we've seen. So even though they've come close, I think it's because of a lot of the brands that they've been selling and probably how well they've done. I'd be surprised if they were as close probably next year with a downturn in premium sales, but I might be wrong.
Watch this space. I mean, the other thing I'll mention is we did a separate little graphic with the top five independent dealers. So Car Giant, Motorpoint, Big Motoring World, Saxton, and Trade Center Group. And there's some alarming drops for a lot of them, aside from Saxton up 8 places in our list, Big Motion World up 9 places, but Motorpoint down 22 places compared to last year's list, Car Giant down 9, Trade Center Group down 21. We've heard some not, I mean, we sound like a stuck record, but we've heard some not fantastic things about how difficult it is to operate in that sector at the minute, just dealing with, particularly on the scale that a lot of these deal with, used car supermarkets have not had a very nice time, and the question is how long is that going to continue, really. Big Motion World is one of the outliers, isn't it? They seem to have some sort of secret sauce that lets them do things in spite of market conditions, don't they? But it was interesting to see Motorpoint and Car Giant drop.
I think when you mention the likes of Motorpoint and some of the bigger ones, they've always had such buying power. Mm. And I think buying power it goes a long way to your success. Certainly, the more cars you buy, the cheaper you can get them for, et cetera, et cetera. You can move them quickly. And then you've got your finance revenue on top of that. But I think they're going to struggle. We all know that stock is in short supply, used car stock, and probably set to get even smaller. You know, when you look at the new car market and you look at part exchanges, probably not coming as back into the market as thick and fast as they once did. You look at ULEZ, you know, you look at clean air zones, which are coming in and around the whole of the UK. And then a lot of those used cars, there's going to be a chunk of used cars that are not going to be clean air compliant. Are dealers going to want to retail some of them cars? Probably yes, depending on where the buyer lives and what they use it for, et cetera, et cetera. But there's going to be some significant changes again. And I think that some of the bigger used car supermarkets who've been used to buying power when there's been lots of stock in the market, I think they're going to find it quite challenging. So I don't think anytime soon we're going to see significant increases in in operating profit or EBIT and revenues as well, unless they do something dynamically different. We've only got to look at Cazoo as an example, you know, and the challenges that they've faced for various different reasons, which I'm sure we could talk about that all day. But I think they're going to struggle. I think they're going to struggle with stock. I really do.
Well, I'll move us on before we have to blow the kazoo.
Just one thing. 2020 was the first year we did car dealer top 100. So this is the fourth time that we've done it, and Arnold Clark have topped the list every single year. So just wants to clear that up.
Well, thank you for that tidbit of information there.
We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, colour preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
I will move us on then, if I may. I'm going to talk about the thing I alluded to in your intro, James Batchelor, which is the malicious actor.
Oh, yes.
Don't know if you know them. That's been editing Virtue Motors' Company's House records. So it's a bit of a bizarre story, really. So Virtue Motors' Company's House records have been maliciously changed. So maliciously, says Virtue Motors. The alterations included various directors being removed, and utterly bizarrely, the appointment of somebody called Mr. Ice Crystal Augustus, who appears to live in a semi-detached house in West Drayton. Slightly peculiarly. So Virtue is now in a slightly awkward position of having to chase Company's House to say, no, we did not request any of these changes. We don't know how this has occurred. I don't know if, I think we've spoken to Company's House, and we spoke to them once, their particular press office, and they were oblivious to what on earth was going on, as you might expect. I'm not quite sure what the situation is now, but Virtue have had to take out some sort of injunction to stop any further changes being made. If you go on there now, they're still on there, these changes. But it's, to me, this is a bizarre situation and slightly worrying, because you think, how do you actually go about making these changes? I actually had a look at how you go about making these changes. Obviously, there's various electronic means to make these amendments, but there's also, you can just download a form. And as far as I can work out, you just fill in the form and send it off to Company's House. I'm not a company director. I don't know anything about this, really. But it's beyond that point. What gets checked? What's to stop me filling in this form, sending it off, and adding myself as a director of Virtue myself? Does it just speak to our slightly peculiar Company's House system? Because, of course, we removed a lot of regulations around it, didn't we? Many, many years ago, I think David Cameron had something to do with it. To ease innovation and all these sorts of things. I'm sure Chris knows more about this than me, but I just thought this is a bizarre situation, and perhaps it's strange to me that we haven't seen it happen before almost.
Yeah, to be honest with you, when I read about it this week, I was the first thing I asked was why?
Yeah.
Why? You know, I just, you know, what's the benefit? I'm not quite sure it's distorted share price or anything like that. I'm sure it hasn't, but I just couldn't figure out why. You know, why would somebody do that? It just seemed like a bizarre idea, even to come up with the idea. But whoever is, you know, whoever the assassin is, so to speak, is what.
Mr.
What's the
Ice
benefit?
Crystal. Yes.
You know, what's the benefit? You know, what's the benefit? I mean, it's found its way into the news, but. I'm not quite sure it's something I would want to put my hand up for, certainly. But, and I think that going back to your point, John, I mean, you know, obviously having a board of directors and shareholders, maybe it's not that difficult. You can actually download a form. Maybe you might need some security information, but, you know, you can just download a form and change it and send it off. I mean, it's normally done by RFD. You know, I just get told to sign here and sign there, and you know, and obviously knowing what it's for, but it's mostly done by RFD. But I don't think it is that that difficult to change these things, maybe barring passing some basic security information. But yeah, a weird one. I still can't figure out why. Why?
I know. I don't think it was a very sophisticated malicious actor, because he added himself as a corporate director and misspelled corporate. So that gives us a level of insight there.
Well, I can only assume it's some kind of in joke, isn't it? Because just going by the name, because I mean, let's face it, if you were going to do this, you would do it properly, wouldn't you? And you'd change one of the directors to Dash Gupta or something, wouldn't you? Or Pam Ayres.
Don't give them any more ideas, Batch. Don't give them any more ideas, please.
Somebody who's, you know, a familiar name. And I never thought I'd actually pair Dash Gupta there with Pam Ayres, but they're two people sprung to mind then. And but Mr. Ice Crystal Augustus, I mean, it's utterly weird, isn't it? And I mean, to give you a latest update, Johnny Ray, so you were asking whether anything has come from it. I mean, they Companies House have spoken to us this morning, and they've said that they've had nothing to do with it. So they don't know what's happened, basically. So I think they're washing their hands of it. So which does sort of call into question exactly what you were saying. Surely this kind of thing must be tightened up, mustn't it? If somebody can just download a form and change somebody's name and it's uploaded and approved, I mean, it really does call into question the whole process, doesn't it? So
yeah, I mean, particularly as a trade publication, James, who's no doubt listening on his way back from wherever he is, we'll be thinking, well, he gets constant updates from Companies House on who directors have changed. He uses that as a handy measure to see if there's any interesting news stories he can write. And that could have been, as you said, if this wasn't so ridiculous, I think that could have been a nice handy news story to generate some headlines, couldn't it? Of suddenly, as you say, Pam Ayres / Dash Gupta becomes a director. You think, oh wow, it's all happening. So I don't understand what the purpose of this was particularly. I just think it's probably a slightly strange individual. I don't know if there's anything you can do with that information. If you're a director on Companies House, can you walk into a bank and say, hello, I'd like to borrow some money against Virtue Motors PLC, please? This is me, I'm the director, Mr. Ice Crystal. Here's my bank account. I don't know if there's any fraud you can carry out as a result of that. No idea. Odd.
It is interesting though, Jake Batch, when you say that Companies House have almost like washed their hands and said nothing to do with us. We might be asking why. They should be asking how. Is what they should be asking. How has somebody done this then? Surely we have to tighten this up if it's that simple.
Yes.
You know, they should be asking how. I hope they are internally.
Just a suspicion. I don't think there are many checks on things performed at Companies House. I think because you hear all these stories about we're the money laundering capital of the world, aren't we?
This can't have been the first time this has happened. I mean, it must happen in other industries all the time. If people have got, you know, grievances against a company and they sort of maliciously.
Yeah. Equally, I should say, it occurred to me this morning, this may not have been a malicious act. It could have just been completely accidental. And Mr. Ice Crystal has his own business that happens to be called Virtue Motors something else. And he's forgotten to put an extra S on or whatever. And it's ended up in changing the details of the wrong company. In that situation, there's still something a bit peculiar going on at Companies House that they're not checking these things. Anyway,
yes,
that's that story. I'll hand it over to you.
Well, I'd like to briefly talk about AI because it's in the headlines a lot this week. And we ran a story. I mean, the only reason why we ran a story was because, of course, there's a slight automotive link. And that was Elon Musk turned up at Rishi Sunak's government's AI summit at Bletchley Park. Before I go on and talk about what Elon Musk spoke about, again, I do urge people to go and check out the photograph that is attached to our story. And it shows Rishi Sunak shaking hands with Elon Musk. And at first I thought perhaps this was a creation of AI because it's an utterly extraordinary photograph. I don't know if it's just me, but I look at this picture and it makes me feel as though Rishi Sunak has, he's so delighted at meeting Elon Musk, but it sort of comes across in the wrong way. And I feel as though it looks like Rishi's sort of delighted about the fact that he's moved Elon Musk to a high interest rate ISA account. He's just so delighted, and Elon Musk just doesn't really care, does he, in this photograph? So again, I know this kind of thing doesn't work on a podcast because it's visual, it's imagery.
I think what you've summed up there, if I may, James Batchelor, is I'll save anyone the effort of watching the 50-minute video. That was the vibe throughout. It was Rishi is absolutely thrilled to have Elon here. And sort of not really that bothered, not really that interested in... Well, I mean, he is interested in engaging, but it was just a... I thought it was a very odd exchange. Anyway, I'll leave it to you.
Well, no, all I was going to sort of really say about this, I mean, I know you can't sort of, you know, Elon Musk is always going to come out with something a little bit inflammatory, isn't he? Because that's just, you know, kind of his personality. And we've seen that's why he's been successful with so many businesses. But I mean, Musk's point in this conference was that he believes AI will one day eliminate jobs and the kinds of jobs that perhaps you and I do, and perhaps you do, Chris, and a wide variety of people, we will no longer have jobs because AI will have taken over them. I think Rishi Sunak was making a slightly more balanced view that AI can, much like a lot of technology does at the moment, it helps us, but it's not going to completely take over our jobs. But of course, Musk thinks something entirely differently. And I just think it makes just for a little bit of interesting reading. I mean, do you think we're getting a little bit kind of bit too crazy about AI? I mean, is the paranoia setting in, do you think? Or is AI actually a force of change that's good?
I think social media fuels this, doesn't it? When you see Boston Dynamics posting videos all across social media and, you know, LinkedIn, and it's getting shared and going viral. And you see these, you know, these Steven Spielberg type robots, you know, jumping off barrels and walking dogs. And it can all be a little bit scary, I think, for some people. I actually watched, bizarrely, I didn't know you were going to chat about this today. I actually watched the Rishi and Elon interview last night in bed. Yeah, exciting things in my bedroom back, you know, watching Elon Musk and Rishi in bed.
Poirot wasn't on.
Well, Elon Musk and Rishi were in bed. So that's going to make a new headline, isn't it?
Yeah, with me. and
move on quick.
It's funny,
the lawyers
because,
get in touch.
I found Rishi, I mean, I think he's an uncomfortable character anyway. He's fairly uncomfortable socially, I always think. I don't know why, but he was like a kid in a sweet shop. It was like he'd won the holy grail of interviews compared to every single world leader, you know, and he was a little bit excitable. And I thought that Elon was very Elon, which was, you know, he didn't really give too much away. That I thought, I watched it and I was a little bit, there's not, the answers he gave were quite wide and quite generic, I thought. I think the bit touching on, you know, AI potentially taking over all our jobs was a little bit in contrast to what he's actually saying. So he's actually saying that AI is going to take over our jobs, but then he's also saying we shouldn't let AI and robots take over the world. Well, if AI is going to take over our jobs, then we're already allowing robots to take over in some degree. So I found it a little bit, some of it a little bit nonsensical, really. Mm. AI is going to help. We've had a play around with ChatGPT, with marketing decks. We wrote a bit of a marketing deck for a brand, and we stuck it into ChatGPT to rewrite the whole marketing deck for us. Mm. Well, you'd think that Redjet was taking cars to space. You know, I mean, honestly, it was phenomenal what it writes about you and your business and how it transforms these marketing decks, to the point where you know that if you'd have sent it someone, they're reading that going, there's no way anyone wrote that. He's human.
Yeah.
So we've had a, and it is quite impressive, and it is quite an exciting tool to a degree. But I see AI taking being involved in automotive on some websites. I think that when we look at the omni-channel approach, you know, we talk about omni-channel, I think there's probably a little bit more that we're going to see from AI. Certainly asking questions into a dealer website where you don't have to wait for somebody to get back to you and that sort of thing. I think we're going to see AI being a little bit transformational across not just automotive, but in general. You want a quick answer, you want an explanation, you want to know about a car. You can't really find it online. Let's call it ChatGPT as an example, but you want to ask a question and you want to get the answers back in seconds rather than researching it yourself, trying to find it, getting incorrect answers, waiting for somebody to come back to you. I see AI transforming the research for consumers within automotive. And I think we'll start seeing little bits of that fairly soon. We've started having a little bit of a play with it ourselves about what Regit might look like from a consumer research perspective utilizing AI. So we're having a little look about that now and talking about that internally.
I think there's definite uses for it. Well, we're seeing uses for it. One of my criticisms about this, I mean, this was just a 50-minute interview, wasn't it? We can't expect it to go into massive depth. No. As you said, Elon was very sort of, he was very pie in the sky. You know, I mean, the story we've written here, he starts talking about magic genies, limitless wishes. He starts talking about humanoid robots taking over the world, Terminator-style things with have to have an off switch, all this sort of stuff.
I think, John, we need to... What Rishi should have put the question to Elon, saying, have you been downloading some forms for Companies House? Because,
Yeah. That's where this butts up against reality, doesn't it? On the one hand, Rishi's there saying the future is wonderful with AI. Meanwhile, you can send a paper form to Companies House and no one checks it. So,
and also, the first name Ice is a little bit of a joke from him because it's internal combustion engine, right?
There you go.
We've solved it.
That'll be it.
Robert Forrester, if you're listening.
It was Elon.
The malicious actor is Elon Musk, the billionaire.
Absolutely. The final thing I'll say on this is I think, and I'm stealing my insight from somebody else here, but there wasn't a lot of detail in this particular conference thing about the actual applications of AI at the minute. It was all very, here's what might happen in 50 years' time and how can we stop that happening, which is all jolly good. And I think, you know, framework needs to be in place to stop these things going completely insane. Whether that will stop them or not is a different matter. But a lot of the issues we've got with AI right now are AI being shoved into gaps that it's not really ready to fill. You know, like Uber were taken to court not that long ago for leaving HR firing decisions to a bit of AI that suddenly decided various drivers were actually taking illegal trips or something bizarre like that and didn't give them any opportunity to put up a defense, just sort of sacked them. We saw, I mean, Batch, you'll remember there was a certain content website that fired its entire editorial team, replaced it with an AI. It was an aggregate website that would pick news stories from various sources. And it replaced it entirely with AI a couple of years ago and then found it had gone completely haywire and was picking all sorts of random things. I think it picked the same story about 30 times at one point. It was just not fit for purpose at that particular point. I think my thing with AI is that we're getting overexcited about it in its current guise and wanting to use it immediately. And perhaps it's not there. I think it's there for lots of things, you know, chatbots and so on, maybe for your, you know, as you say, if you go onto a used car dealer's website, I think the products are there to have AI perform that chat and get details from the person and see what cars they're interested in. I think that's a great example. But some things it's not ready for.
You know, John, I think you're right, because I think, of course, we have to take AI seriously and we have to look at how we potentially could integrate whatever technology is available into our businesses, into our daily lives to make things better. You know, we all know with everything, with the greater good comes bad, right? And we have to make sure that we focus on the greater good. But going to your point, I think you're right, because it was only 12 months ago that Metaverse was going to take over the world, right? And it was my LinkedIn feed was just every day, every minute, the Metaverse, the Metaverse, the Metaverse. I mean, it was literally going to take over the world. We don't really hear that much about it anymore, do we, if I'm completely honest?
Mm.
You know, it's now all AI. So the thing is with tech is it moves sometimes
in trends
a little bit too fast for its own good. And it doesn't really it doesn't always necessarily execute things that it says it's going to execute, et cetera, et cetera. And then something else comes along and we move on to that. Maybe it's a small combination of all that we see in the future. who knows?
Mm. Watch this space. Mm. I'll move us on then, Charlie. That was your story, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What shall I pick? I will go with... I'm going to go with the Toyota Prius.
Oh, I've got that down.
It's coming back. That's the end of the story. No, Toyota released quite an interesting looking Prius not that long ago to the rest of the world. We were one of the very few markets that said, nope, don't want it. Toyota UK, not interested in bringing the Prius back to these shores. The reason they said is because it sold so few cars, so few Priuses in the last full year on sale, which was 2021. They sold 563 Priuses in a year compared to 18,000 CHRs. So Toyota's argument was, well, we'll never sell any, which is fair enough. But they've now had a bit of an about turn because this particular new Prius actually looks rather good. And reaction has been very positive, I think, in the UK press and around the world. So they're now going to bring it to our shores, albeit only in plug-in hybrid form, not just regular hybrid, which I think is also available. But it's a bit of a win-win for them, isn't it? Because they get another car. And also, as a plug-in hybrid, it lowers their fleet average CO2 emissions.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the first time that Toyota has made a decision that really makes no sense whatsoever. When they said we are definitely not taking this car, I just thought, why wouldn't you? Because it's just adding more choice for the customer, isn't it? And especially with the Prius, yes, they might not have sold a huge number of them in 2021, but seeing though that car, it'd be an interesting survey to run, wouldn't it? But I still think if you went up to people in the street and you said, name me a hybrid car, I think a sizable proportion of people would say Toyota Prius, wouldn't they? And so to get rid of that car in your UK lineup, to me, just didn't make sense. So I'm glad that they said they're going to bring it back. But I just sort of question why on earth did they... it was a stupid decision to say they weren't going to take it in the first place.
I can sort of see why they didn't, because, of course, we're manufacturing hybrid cars here in the UK, aren't we? The Corolla and the lovely Suzuki Swace that you're driving, which is the same thing.
Yes.
There's an argument for why do you import one from half the world away that fundamentally does the same job, because it's still a hatchback, isn't it? It's probably about the same size as a Corolla Estate. If I was an Uber driver, I'd be going Prius or Corolla Estate. You know, which one's better, which one's cheaper?
Yeah.
You really need two in that same arena. But anyway, it'll be a plug-in hybrid, which is slightly different.
Can't wait to drive it.
Indeed. It looks very nice.
Yes.
Shall I hand it back to you?
Yes. I'm approaching my final story now because I had the Prius down as well. It's just about Jaguar Land Rover. We've got to... you know, we always talk about Kazoo. Story as well. We talk about Kazoo. We talk about Jaguar Land Rover a lot, don't we? And I know this was a topic of conversation on the podcast last week, so I won't repeat everything that was... discussed them, but the headline figure is that we discovered, along with Autocar, I believe, that we discovered it first, that 10,000 JLR products, cars, they're stuck at dealers because there's this massive parts shortage. And JLR have been telling their dealers, look, you know, the reasons for it, blah, 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 blah. I mean, the news this week is just a little bit more on that topic, saying that they're just apologising. There's also stories that some dealers are using secondhand car parts. We've heard that from some dealers who have said that's absolutely not happening. I mean, what is clear here, it doesn't matter what part of the story is true or untrue. This is an enormous problem, one which... shouldn't really happen, should it? But it has happened. And I mean, JLR need to fix this problem as soon as possible, because having 10,000 cars off the road, I mean, that's 10,000, potentially 10,000 customers who won't buy another car in the future, really, isn't it? And I know JLR are working flat out to try and fix this solution, fix this problem, but it is an enormous one, and one that shouldn't really happen. But it's set against this wider news which came out this week, and it is great news. I mean, you know, you do feel as though there's a lot of negativity around JLR at the moment, but we do want them to succeed. And I know a lot of our audience wants them to succeed because they've got franchises with JLR. But the important thing is that they celebrated record first half revenues. They swung into profit. Pre-tax profit was 442 million in Q2 and 877 million for the first half, which is great because they've had quite a few years of pain, as we know. And the order bank is very, very strong. I mean, it's come down quite a bit, which is good because the backlog was huge, but it's still at 168,000 cars by the end of the first quarter. By the end of the second quarter. The Range Rover, the Range Rover Sport and the Defender accounted for 77% of those orders, which is extraordinary, really, isn't it? If you think about it, because that that means that the remaining, if my maths is good here, 23% of those cars is the rest of the range, which is Evoque, Velar, Discovery Sport and Discovery.
Discovery, yeah. It's a vast proportion.
Yes. So some sort of bad news that this story is still going on about the fact of the parts shortage, but they have come out and apologized. And also there's this news that they are in profit now. So yes, good and bad news.
Can I talk a little bit about the used parts?
Of course you may.
There, yes. Which we sort of quickly covered. So as you say, we spoke to a dealer who said, not in a million years would I'm paraphrasing, put a used part into someone's repair Land Rover. I mean, we've talked about used parts before, and I should say Jaguar Land Rover say that some dealers do use, as they say, locally sourced parts, which as long as they're fit for purpose and meet JLR specifications, JLR is quite happy for them to do that. So JLR is sort of the vote of whatever fixes the car, as long as it doesn't make it worse, fine, is what it sounds like. And I'm sort of that opinion as well. I think if it was my Range Rover in there and it had been in there for 4 months and I was struggling to get a wiper motor or something, I would be at the point of just going, do you know what? Whatever. Just put something in there, put a rubber band in there or something. Just get it back to me. I've had enough of this. And that sentiment aside, I think also there is a conversation to be had about used, or as we may like to call them, remanufactured parts. And is it such a bad thing that they're being used? I think it depends on the situation. I think if there was a tear in my seat or something, I wouldn't want someone's secondhand car seat coming into my car, but an alternator or something like that, I don't really have a major problem with it if it was me.
No, I know. I agree with you. And I think the vast majority of customers, they just want their cars back. And but like with everything, it's how it's dealt with, isn't it? If the customer is made aware, look, your car needs X part. We're trying to source a brand new one, but we are using a reconditioned part here, for example, and it's explained to them, and it's explained that the car is going to be much quicker to hand over because of that, and it's up to standards, blah blah blah, and the whole customer experience is top notch. I think most customers, it's a massive generalization, I know, but I think most customers would be absolutely fine. Just give me back the car that I've spent £150,000 on. ASAP. What do you think, Chris?
It's a really interesting one because it actually happened to me this year. So, funnily enough, I've experienced this. And, you know, this supply problem isn't unique to JLR. This is, you know, wide within the UK currently, I'm presuming in Europe as well, with many, many brands. So, obviously, I drive a Mercedes, which is a few years old now. It's the first time I've ever bought a used car in the last 20 years. So it's my first used car because I didn't want to buy another new petrol or diesel. And I wasn't ready for electric, you know, because I want the technology to evolve, advance. I want more choice. I always thought they would come down in price. So within the next 24 months, I'm going to move to an EV. So anyway, I bought this nice, lovely used Mercedes SL, which I absolutely love. Low mileage, few years old, beautiful car. I'm absolutely in love with it. Probably keep it, actually, rather than get rid of it at some point. But I started to get water ingress into the headlight. So, and its MOT was due. So took it to a specialist in Macclesfield who is recognised by Mercedes and all the right diagnostic equipment, and it can all go on the system, etc., etc. And he rang them while I was there. He said, look, this problem tends to be an ECU unit within the headlight. It can be expensive. I'm going to ring them in front of you. So he rang local Mercedes-Benz dealer. So look, we need a new headlight. We need it with an ECU. So in total, the cost would have been around, for the new unit, the new ECU, everything that goes with it, we were looking at around £1,200. Yeah. Mm. So of course I was like, whoa. But then she said, and even if I could get you one, which I can't, and I've got absolutely no idea when I can get you one. I was like, are you talking like the whole of the UK Mercedes-Benz that you can't get me an SL350 headlight? A few, you know, like, no, because of the supply chain problem at the moment, there's just certain parts that they've stopped, whether it's making or bringing into the country. I was like, it's due an MOT in like 10 days and I need the headlight working for it to pass the MOT. Mm. So I've bought this used Mercedes that I can't get a headlight for, which basically means that I can't MOT, which means the car's off the road. And this is part of the problem. I think it's been highlighted with JLR because of maybe their problem being fairly significant. So my next move was, well, I'll just get a second-hand one then. So we go on the internet for a second-hand one. Obviously, everybody's got the same opinion. I think in the whole of the UK, in terms of the model number that I needed for my car, I think there was 3 in the whole of the UK. And they were priced virtually the same as the new one, £1,000. Mm. You're talking about a cut. So obviously these breaker guys or the parts guys that understand that you can't get these new parts, of course, like everything, supply and demand problem, price goes through the roof, right? Yeah. So I'm like, oh my God. So I just could not believe that the price I was potentially going to have to pay to get this car back on the road, and Mercedes-Benz telling me they've got absolutely no idea. Now, it isn't just unique to Mercedes-Benz. I've read this now so many times online with people that just can't get cars for parts for their cars. Now, if the situation with JLR around they're putting used parts in, going back to your point, James, I think that if I had a Jaguar Land Rover and they said to me, we can't get you a new one, the only way to get your car back on the road is it's a used part. It's not going to cost you as much, but it is going to cost you this. Like you said, John, I'll be absolutely fine with that, because ultimately you just want your car. It's about transparency, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It's about transparency. It's about being honest. This is the situation. This is how we can get you out of it. And it is going to be a little bit cheaper. But on the basis that there's a supply problem and demand problem for these parts, they're still not cheap. And the dealer's got to make a margin. So it's got to be about transparency and honesty. But here's an interesting one for you. I've got around my problem. So then, and I'm not quite sure that everybody is, and it depends on the part that you need. So then my guy who I know really well at my Mercedes specialist in Macclesfield, he's great and very honest and very transparent and has done a lot of work for a lot of people that I know with Mercedes cars, and that's how he got recommended to me. He said to me, there is another option. So I said, what is it? He went, Chinese part, can get you a Chinese ECU. So I was like, what? He was like, yeah. He went, £45. So he said, it might work, it might not. He said, I've put some in and they work, and I've put some in and they don't. And I said, for £45, give it a shot. So he went, right, I'll order you one now. So anyway, he rang me up, told me it's in, took the car back. Luckily, the MOT had 10 and 12 days, yeah. So he said, right, leave it with me. I said, but can you, I need you to, so I said, if it works, I just need you to MOT the car, like now, like get it done. So I get it through the MOT. Yeah. Literally rings me back. And of course, bated breath 2 days later or whatever it is. I was like, please, you know, this, he went, are you ready for this? I was like, oh, come on, Pete, just tell me, just tell me. He went, it's worked. So I'd gone from 1,200 quid to 120 quid, including the MOT, 140 quid, including fitting in a bit of labour. Yeah. So it cost me 140 quid to solve a 1,200 quid problem.
But it just goes to show, doesn't it? Like we were saying, you know, if there is an option and it means you get your car quicker.
Yeah.
You know.
And you largely forget about it. You forget that you've got a secondhand ECU or headlight or whatever, or Chinese ECU.
Oh yeah, I know. And I'm not saying, and I will stand corrected here, but I doubt that virtually every single part in the Mercedes-Benz is made in Germany. So it doesn't really probably matter, does it?
So we've got an influx of Chinese EVs coming, right? So I'm now of my next business idea is basically Chinese parts, importing Chinese parts.
Yes. Yeah.
There's and marking them up.
Right.
Well, we look forward to talking to you on the podcast next year about that, Chris.
Great. Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'm out of stories. You're out of stories, Batch.
I am indeed.
So, Chris, before we ask for your verdict, are there any stories you think we've missed this week?
I don't think so. Maybe I think you've covered most of the bigger ones. I think we're in a very as challenging as automotive is for lots of different ways. It's very volatile. It's inconsistent. It's difficult to plan. It's also an incredibly exciting place to be, isn't it? Mm. I mean, you know, we're on the verge of allegedly the fourth industrial revolution with EVs, and you know, the only thing I would like to add is I'd like to see some more technology evolving. You know, it can't be full EV. You know, I'd like to see some new stories come into the market soon where we know there's some breakthroughs with synthetic fuel and biofuel. Hydrogen is arguable. Certainly Mr. Elon Musk will tell you categorically that hydrogen is the worst idea in the world. But I think I'd like to see some new stories with technology advancing. I think we'll see stories around, you know, longer battery life, longer range, that sort of thing. You know, there's some challenges. I think insurance might be one we've missed. Insurance premiums going up on EVs significantly because they don't know how to price them based on maybe batteries going. So I think that's challenging for the market. But I'd like to see some good stories coming where we're evolving technology. I'd like to see if we can hopefully keep the ICE engine in some way. And gosh, if you put that out there on the podcast, I'm in for a bit of trouble off the evangelists. But I'd like to see a mix. I'd like to see a mix of technology which helps the environment is what I'd like to see. So hopefully some new stories on that in the future.
Mm. We will take note on that. I mean, we did run a hydrogen BMW story last week, of course, but that's not this week. So I'm going to have to ask you, who chose the best stories this week, if you who chose them? Or which were your best stories? I fear it's going to go to Batch. I can just feel it.
I know. I quite like the Arnold Clark one, actually, if I'm honest, for reasons of the point that I said. I don't think it's a coincidence that they're still privately owned and they're still top of the tree. And I think it comes down being able to move quickly, be agile, be entrepreneurial. I think it's going to take a lot to topple them. I really do. I think they're an innovative top five group. The JLR one is an interesting one, obviously, with the parts, because I've suffered that myself. So I'm sorry, John. I might have to go with Batch, unfortunately. I'm really, really sorry, mate.
Don't be sorry. Listen, I had the better stories, Chris. Don't feel sorry.
I can live with that. I'll let that go. Well, on that note, All that's left for me to say is thank you, Chris, for coming and judging today. It's been great to have you on and great to hear about Reggit as well. And of course, great to hear of your first car sale. That was perhaps my, my favourite bit of the entire episode. Probably my Batches Baldwin, as well.
Unbelievable.
Actually, can I change my mind, Batch? On the basis of John's research, I think he wins.
No, no, it's done. It's done. It's been lovely having you, Chris. Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Oh, dear. I'll let you have it, Batch. I'll be fair.
Thank you.
Well, no, thank you as well to Batch for competing, and thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode and hopefully more insights on Coronation Street Stars car purchases. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you're listening on Spotify, swipe up now and vote on who you think won. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, you can click the links in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Thanks again, and until next time, goodbye.